welcome to episode number 30 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Wow, 30 episodes. This one will be centering on Jack and the Beanstalk. It's my pleasure. I'm Jerry Shario, first of all, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you a man who promises to be out of your guest bedroom by the end of the month, Nick Santa Maria.
That's if Mr. Fields doesn't throw me out for non-payment. I tried to convince him that 7 times 13 is 28, and he wouldn't listen. No, he's bald. But anyway, I love when Lou calls him a bald-headed janitor in the show. You bald-headed janitor. But anyway, hiya, Jerry. It's good to see you.
Yes, and it's good to see you, sir. My goodness, you've had a time.
Well, it's the closest I've come to being dead. To be honest with you, it was quite a story. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, we had to delay the recording of this episode. Number 30. I can't believe it. 30. Doesn't look 30.
Yes.
It looks younger. But that's hair dye. So one night, I'm a very bad sleeper. I have insomnia out the butt. And I couldn't sleep. And I went to my doctor, and he recommended a medicine called Seroquel. And you're supposed to take a whole one. So the first night I took a whole one, and I found myself, I sleep with no clothing. I'm a naked sleeper. I was walking around the apartment completely naked, walking into walls. I even walked into my mother's room. Luckily it was covered by a piece of furniture. It was like Austin Powers, you know, when he was walking and it just happens to be covered.
Yes.
Which is an old silent movie trope, by the way. But anyway, that was a bad night. And I thought, well, I'll cut them in half. I'll cut it in half. So I cut it in half, took it. I got out of bed, sound asleep, and about 5 feet from my bed is my desk. And my desk, the top drawer was ajar. It was open. So the sharp edge of the drawer was pointing out. I fell without the use of my hands. I fell with my head against the drawer. And it ripped my scalp off. I mean, not completely, but about halfway. I was on the floor bleeding. I'm looking at the spot right now. And I dragged myself back to bed because all of a sudden I was completely exhausted. And that's what happens when you have a head injury. You just want to sleep. So I crawled into bed and I slept. As I was bleeding all over my pillows and everything else, I had no idea what was going on. And I woke up about 45 minutes later and said, and this is what saved my life. I said, I better get out and look at this because I scratched my head and my scalp came up. You talk about scary.
Mm.
And it just so happens, it gets worse. It just so happens that my room in this apartment that I share with my 94-year-old mother, who was sound asleep in her room, I didn't want to bother her. What was I saying? I'm sorry, my head injury.
Yeah. You reached up, realized something was right.
And I had to drag myself out of bed. And I did. I stood up and immediately fell again and hit the top of my head on a piece of furniture. Got myself up and fell again and hit the top of my head. Anyway, my room was completely dark. For some reason, the breakers did not work in my room that night. So I'm completely in the dark. I dragged myself into the bathroom, turned on the light, lifted my head, and I was suddenly a convertible. I saw my skull. Did you ever see your skull?
I did. No!
Yeah, I did. Sorry. And I decided then and there, I didn't want to wake my mom. I didn't want to worry her. So I went back into the dark, dark room and dressed as best I could. I wrote a little note for my mom saying I had a bad fall. I'm at this hospital. I will be back, I'll contact you later, and drove myself to the hospital with a big bath towel wiping my head as I drove. I get to the hospital and I forget that I have a handicap sticker from my mom, and I park about a mile away, and I had to walk to the emergency room. Wiping my head. I walked in and it was as if, you know, the queen mother walked in, you know, oh, come here, darling. Everybody just jumped. They just got on their feet. And I was in surgery in seconds. And this woman who sewed me up, I was telling Jerry, it's like, I thought she was Betsy Ross. That's how great her sewing skills were. And I'm looking at my scar right now and it's already halfway gone. It's amazing. So I did what everyone should do. If you have a head injury, rest. Just rest until you're feeling better. I had ribs injury. I had to get over that. It was a terrible thing. But I'm back, folks, and Yay! We're raring to go. It's like now we're going to feel better and we're going to move forward. And I'm looking forward to it.
And what better movie to be talking about?
Really?
Let's just feel good.
This is a feel-good movie.
It really is.
And boy, what a story behind it and all of this. I've got so many good notes and things about the people and everything else. So I did a lot of work. Let's get going. Yeah, let's get going. Okay, so Jack and the Beanstalk, 1952, 77 minutes. And this is sort of I don't want to say the F-bomb, but this is sort of a screw you to Universal Studios.
Mm-hmm.
Abbott and Costello had been begging for a color film, for Universal to take their most profitable stars and give them the same sort of treatment that Danny Kaye was getting and Martin and Lewis were getting and Bob Hope was getting. And Abbott and Costello was making more money than anyone. And Universal still refused to give them color film. So they, in their contract, they were allowed to do one independent film a year. And the first one they did was Africa Screams. And was it New Sangs High? And then Africa Screams. Yeah. So this, they decided that Lou was going to produce and own this film with his company, Exclusive Productions. And Bud would own the next one, which would be Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. That would be their independent film the following year. And his Woodley Productions would do that, and Lou would work for Bud. And Bud was working for Lou. So since Lou was basically the producer and the owner of this film, he went to Alex Gottlieb, the guy who produced their first 10 films. And boy, what a great guy to go to. He was very happy to come back, especially knowing that Lou was in charge of like budgeting and everything else. So he knew that it wasn't going to be the pie throwing Bobby Barber, you know, let's stop everything, you know, and put seltzer down somebody's pants. That was kept to a minimum. And Lou, he wanted the movie made for like $400,000. I mean, which is like ultra B movie. Luckily, saner heads prevailed, and it turned out to be $682,580.
Okay.
And it ended up making $1.6 million here in the States. In England, it became the biggest hit of the year across the board. Yeah, became the biggest film of the year. Jack and the Beanstalk. I fear nothing when I'm in the rain. Which is funny. Lou was a conservative Republican, and when I think about it, I fear nothing when I am in the right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Little subtle messages there, you know? Joe McCarthy wasn't all good intentions. The movie was filmed at the Hal Roach Studios, where another comedy team used to toil. And here's something I want you all to look at. When you watch the film, in the early scenes that take place in the house where they have to babysit, mm-hmm. It's their apartment house from the TV show. It's Mr. Fields' apartment house with wallpaper and all this all dressed up. They were already shooting the show. And everybody in this movie in the background was shooting the Abbott and Costello show at the same time. Ah. Same director, you know, Pat Costello was the producer. He was the producer of this one. So actually they got everything done. They were doing so well at this point. Television really gave them a whole new lease on life, and they signed a $15 million deal with NBC for the next like 4 or 5 years to do the Colgate Comedy Hours, their TV show, you know, and they were free to do movies and everything else. So they were just really on fire. And it just makes you realize that once the tax troubles started, and this is around the time it started, they had so much money. What did they do with it? What the hell did they do with it? You know, I know that Lou liked to invest, and he was usually bad investments. He was a gambler, you know, just like Bud mm-hmm. was. Mm-hmm. He owned racehorses, you know. I mean, they spent. They bought yachts, and, you know, Lou actually adapted a Navy cruiser and turned it into a yacht. So, you know, these guys, they were making a fortune. And, you know, what happened to it? Where'd it go? But anyway, that's here nor there. And one of the things Alex Gottlieb insisted on in his contract when he said yes to this was that he didn't have to play cards with them. Which was the bane of his existence during those first 10 films. But no, Lou said, oh, no, no card playing. No, we have to get this done on time and blah, blah, blah. So you had Gene Yarborough directing, who was a dynamo. He got it in, I think, 2 days ahead of schedule and a little under budget. But the boys wanted color. They wanted color more than anything. And Lou, being, you know, the producer in charge of the spending, didn't want to spring for Technicolor, which would have been very expensive. So they went with the next best thing. In 1932, they developed the Cinecolor Company. And it was just a two-strip color company, which means I believe there weren't yellows or greens or something like that. Some mm-hmm. colors from the spectrum were not involved. But it looked okay. You know, it looked okay. If you want something color and you can't afford it, you get Cinecolor. But then later on, they developed Super Cinecolor, and it was actually a three-strip color alternative to the cheaper version. But the thing is, and this would have gotten me too, I can't blame Lou for this because I would have thought this too, especially if it was my money. This was only 20% more expensive than black and white, and you got wow. a really, you watched it, Jerry.
Yeah.
The color, it's like a storybook.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's wonderful. So I think, you know, he made the right choice, definitely, mm-hmm. as far as his budget was concerned. And they got to do a color movie. And Bud did the same thing with Captain Kidd the following year. And it looks great. It looks mm-hmm. great. So anyway, the boys got their color film. It's funny, the opening titles, it says Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, you know, in. And underneath are building blocks, you know, toys. And there's A and C down at the bottom. So I only noticed that, not this time, but when I was writing the book.
Yeah.
And that's my chapter. So I looked at the film again and I caught it for the very first time. Very nice. According to legend, Lou was actually reading Jack and the Beanstalk to his daughter, Chris. And as he was reading it, he thought, this would make a great movie. This is something we could do. He was tired of hearing the critics say, oh, they're doing the same routines over and over again. It's the same stuff. And he says, even though that stuff gets laughs, no matter when we do it or where we do it, it was time to do something different. And so he took the bull by the horns. And this was developed over at Universal. They didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. So he took the project over to Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers co-financed with him and released the film as a Warner Brothers movie, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Definitely an A studio, definitely a studio more prestigious than Universal. So I think he did the right thing there too. What he didn't do was, let's talk about the writers. Nat Curtis gets sole credit for writing, and it's actually accurate this time. Nat Curtis, born in Astoria, Queens, in 1909 or seven, and lived to 1983. He wrote a few of those Joe McDoakes shorts, Behind the Eight Ball. I love those. He wrote a few of those. He wrote Blood on the Sun for James Cagney, a wartime drama. He wrote The Harvey Girls for Judy Garland and Ray Bolger. He adapted William Saroyan's Pulitzer Prize winning play, The Time of Their Lives. No, The Time of Your Life. Time of Their Lives is Abbott and Costello. and that was 1948, also James Cagney. And one of the most boring movies I've ever sat through. it's so pretentious.
Yeah.
You know, it was during that time, things like The Hairy Ape came out and all these like allegorical mm-hmm. Plays. Anyway, so he did that. And TV, right from the get-go. I mean, the earliest sitcoms you can think of, The Stu Irwin Show, Beulah with Hattie McDaniel, and later some others, My Little Margie, and The Dick Van Dyke Show later on. So he did a lot of TV, and he was the sole writer. Now, Alex Gottlieb approached Lou and said, Lou, this script needs a lot of work. And Lou's like, no, I like it. I like it the way it is. This is what we're shooting. And that's that. And Alex said, you're the boss. Okay, that's fine. I agree with Alex. I think the script could have been better. It's a delightful film, no doubt. It's a, it really is. It really is a fun and funny fantasy. Now, my favorite credit during the opening credits is story by Pat Costello. He wrote Jack and the Beanstalk. A story whose roots go back to 1734, marked down from 1800. But it's story by Pat Costello. Anyway, that makes me laugh. Basically,
he doesn't look that old, you know?
No, he doesn't. And he is the older brother. But he's Pat Costello. So, apparently he came up with the idea to say, let's go from black and white to color. And I'm like, I guess he saw The Wizard of Oz,
Yeah.
It's just so weird. And he also gets a producer credit on this film. And he also did some doubling. He also did a little double work on this one. So Pat Costello, we didn't really do this. He was born in 1902 in Paterson, New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not. And he lived to 1990. He was 87 when he died.
Wow.
He had the resilience his brother lacked. His name originally was Anthony Sebastian Cristillo. Served in World War I with honors. Got out, learned the saxophone. He was quite a good jazz saxophonist, had his own orchestra. And he's the one that got Lou to change his name to Costello rather than Cristello. He was the first one to do it. Now, later, Lou tells stories about, Helene Costello or Dolores Costello. I got it from that one, from the silent movies. No, he got it from his brother. I don't know where he got these stories from, but his brother thought Costello was easier. It was the Pat Costello Orchestra. And Lou said, yeah, that's easier. I'm going to take that. So he did. He did stunt doubling for his brother all the way up to Little Giant. And then he got a little too old to do that stuff. He co-starred in Mexican Hayride, as we've learned. And he also, his last doubling for his brother was in 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock, the last movie his brother made. So it was kind of nice that he was there and, you know, even Bobby Barber's in that movie. It's great. And apparently, and this is the most fascinating thing, and I hate the fact that I'll probably have to sit through the movie again, but he has a bit part as a party guest in Jerry Lewis's Three on a Couch, which could be called Three on an Ouch. It's a horrible movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, Pat is in it, and I want to see what he looks like in 1966. But anyway, he also produced for his brother's production company, I Am the Law, a syndicated television show starring George Raft. And didn't last long, didn't do very well, but that's what he did. So that's Pat. Pat did well for himself. There were also gags by Felix Adler, who's come up many times during this podcast. Not the famous clown, but the famous gag writer who worked forever for Jules White at Columbia, for the Stooges, for Abbott and Costello. He was quite the gag man. So he was involved as well. I'm trying to think what else about this film. Yes, it was filmed on the sets of the movie Joan of Arc, which was a big bomb for Ingrid Bergman as Joan of Arc. Yeah, they should have put the producers on the stake, you know, before they lit the match. That's another movie that's just like a when does it end? But anyway, I was fascinated by it only because she gets burned at the end. You know, that's that fascination as a kid. You know, what must that be like? Ugh, it must be the most horrible death ever, except having to watch that movie. So, okay, I guess we can get to the movie now itself.
Okay.
It does open with the song, Jack and the Beanstalk, which is catchy. The songs by Bob Russell and Lester Lee are quite good, actually. And they're even better in Captain Kidd, the same team. And fascinating guys. Both lived only into their mid-50s. They were quite young when they passed away. But they did some great things. I mean, what was Bob Russell wrote with Duke Ellington? Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. Don't Get Around Much Anymore. I mean, that's great stuff.
Yeah.
Concerto for Cootie, who was Cootie Williams, his trumpet player. He wrote that. just great stuff. He wrote the lyrics for, are you ready? Babaloo. Babaloo. Ha, 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 Lucio Stefani. Yeah, I mean, really, really some great stuff. But Bob Russell was born in 1914, lived to 1970. What else? His real name was Sidney Keith Rosenthal. He went to Washington University in St. Louis. Washington and St. Louis, that's interesting. Worked when he got out for an ad agency, writing copy and songs. His roommate at the time was Sidney Sheldon, the writer.
Oh,
yeah. Then he started writing material for vaudeville acts, you know, say, selling material to them when they were in town. He started writing in the, for movies in the early 50s. 1968, he and Quincy Jones were nominated for an Oscar for the song For the Eyes of Love from a movie called Banning, B-A-N-N-I-N-G. Never saw it. Then again, nominated the following year for The Love of Ivy, the theme song to that movie, which starred Sidney Poitier. Mm-hmm. Now, Lester Lee, wow, yeah, he only lived to be 52. He was born in 1903, died in 1956 of a heart attack. He was nominated for an Oscar for the movie Miss Sadie Thompson wrote a song, Sadie Thompson's song, they called it, but I know it has a different name. But he also wrote one of my favorite Andrew Sisters songs, The Pennsylvania Polka. The Pennsylvania Polka. I actually wrote a parody of that for a show called The Paranoia Polka. It was after 9/11 and nobody trusted anybody. So
yeah,
so it was the Paranoia Polka. But anyway, so these boys had credits and they had gravitas and they wrote some pretty good songs. Mm-hmm. The ballads, things like Darlene and the Dreamer's Cloth or whatever it was, those you could, you know, set aside to a nice try. But yeah. But the songs for the chorus, for the Norman Luboff chorus, the choir, and Lou himself singing is fantastic. But we'll get to all of that. Okay, so movie starts in black and white, sepia, and we see that James Alexander, our leading man, is coming up to the house where he's going to pick up his girlfriend. And they are in a play together, and they have to go to the play. Unfortunately, the child that needs babysitting probably would have made a good Nazi. he's a real brat. And let me just get this out of the way as we come across these people. James Alexander, boy, he died when he was 46. 1914 to 1961, born in Richmond, Indiana. He started acting late in life at 38 years old. This was his first film, Jack and the Beanstalk. He was on a couple of episodes of the Abbott and Costello TV show. And he made a few other movies, Port of Hell, Treasure of Ruby Hills, Las Vegas Shakedown, which I have to look for, and a movie called Night Freight. And this was all within 1953 to 1955, very short-lived. But his biggest credit was he was chosen to be Curly, not with the Three Stooges, in the play Oklahoma. He was Curly in the Road Company. He wasn't the Broadway Curly. He was the Road Company Curly, yeah. And he had that voice. He had good looks, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was his main claim to fame. And it's funny, he married his leading lady, Mary Hatch. And when they started falling apart, the producers split them up and gave them each a company, each a road company. That's how popular it was. And David Stollery is the little boy, playing the little boy, the rotten little kid, born in 1941 in Los Angeles. He's still around. His biggest claim to fame was playing Spin and Marty. He was Marty. In Spin and Marty on the Mickey Mouse Club, which I used to watch, you know, in reruns when I was a kid.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Yeah. But then he did a lot of acting. He did a right after this, he was learning lines while he was shooting this film. He was about to open in a production of On Borrowed Time. I don't know if you guys remember the movie, the MGM film from 1939, Lionel Barrymore, Cedric Hardwick, Beulah Bondi, and the little kid, Bobs Watson, whose specialty was to cry and just make you want to hit him on the head with a baseball bat. annoying is a not a good enough word for Bob Watson. He's one of the Watson family. The kids all had careers. They had great looks. And but this one, Bob, stop crying. You just want to yell, you know. I remember him in, I think it was the sequel to Boys Town, Men of Boys Town. His dog is killed or something and was run over, and he cries for the rest of the movie. Yeah, Spencer Tracy, hit him. Hit him with one of your old bottles. So in the 1970s, he left show business completely. He went to the Art Center of Design, and he ended up designing automobiles for General Motors and then Toyota. So I think he came up with the first Celica, Toyota Celica. So that was David Stollery. I mean, I think that's pretty amazing. But he showed up in movies. He was uncredited in Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court with Bing Crosby. He was on a Lucy episode, I Love Lucy, and Dragnet. And yeah, he worked a lot. He worked a lot. And when you wanted a bratty kid or snobby kid, intelligent, you got David Stollery. So he's the kid that the boys have to babysit. So Shay Cogan, who plays the leading lady here, we saw her in Coming Round the Mountain, dressed as a boy.
Yes. And the first thing that I noticed in this movie, in the opening credits, it gives her an introducing credit. Yeah.
Right.
But she's already been in a movie.
I know. That's something producers do all the time, though. You know, it's like, in fact, I probably say that most times they say introducing, people have already done films. You know, it's even small parts or uncredited, whatever. But she was in, but she didn't look anything like she looked in this movie. She looks she's so pretty in this movie. And in the other one, she was playing a boy, basically.
Yeah.
She was dressed as a boy. But anyway, we talked about her last time and Coming Around the Mountain, and she is our leading lady. And she calls a babysitting service because nobody who knows David Stollery will do the job. They know better. So we cut to a car riding down the road, almost hitting a little man who happens to be Bobby Barber, who jumps out of the way. And of course, Lou slams into the car in front of him, backs up and hits a police car, knocking the policeman out of the car and onto the ground. So this is their introduction, the boys. And Lou, of course, runs to Buddy Bayer, who's a, 6'7", and is always running into his chest where his head comes to, and like a wall. It's just so funny. So he gets into it with the cop, and they go into the employment agency, which is called the Cosman Employment Agency, and that's the inside joke. Cosman Productions was a production company Lou started with their manager, Eddie Sherman. So Costello, Sherman, Cosman. So that's the joke. But they go in, and they sell themselves as first-class babysitters. Lou gets to keep 10% of everything he makes. And he starts flirting with the beautiful woman at the desk. And her name is Dorothy Ford, who was also in Here Come the Coeds as one of the glamazons, one of the Amazon women that come to play basketball against the college team. Gorgeous woman, just gorgeous, and a real Eiffel, let me tell you. I mean Eiffel Tower. Lou is telling her, oh, I love women like you, 5'2", eyes of blue. And then she stands up. And Lou is like 5'5", So and she's 6'2". She's enormous and really quite beautiful. I think we went into her background during Here Come the Coeds. But briefly, she was a Billy Rose hired her first swimmer in the Aquacade that he produced for the San Francisco exhibition. And then I think it was 1941 or something like that. Anyway, she wore this bright white bathing suit, and she's 6'2", and she's standing with the other girls. And that was it. You're number one. Come on. You're hired. I don't care if you swim. I don't care. Whatever it is, just come. You're hired. So she did that for a while. And then she went over to Earl Carroll's and became one of his beautiful chorus girls. And that eventually led to movies. And, she made some uncredited things. She made about 39 movies. Mm. And she shows up in Love Laughs at Andy Hardy. Can you imagine Mickey Rooney dancing with Dorothy Ford? I mean, it would echo into her navel, you know, everything he was saying, hello, 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 Pinocchio, you know. but anyway, yeah, she made a few other movies, and she was just fantastic, you know. She worked with the Bowery Boys twice, and Martin and Lewis, and, you know, she was just great. She was just great. And I believe that there were certain people in this movie that Lou had personal contracts with. I know Shay Cogan, he had a contract with. James Alexander, definitely, because he shows up in two of their Abbott and Costello shows. And I'm thinking that Dorothy Ford, you know, she's here. She shows up on the TV show. She was in Here Come the Coeds. I don't know. And maybe Lou had a thing about, you know, her being so tall and beautiful. Who knows?
Yeah,
I know. I would have been very impressed. Her measurements, for those of you that are interested, I know I am, 38, 26, 38 and a half. I'll take it. 6 foot two, like I said, original name, Dorothy Eyre Gardner Ford. Born in 1922, died in 2010 at the age of 88. Very nice. Yeah. So, yeah, she did very well for herself. So the cop comes in. He's the boyfriend. And, of course, there's more annoyance from Bud and Lou. And so they're on their way to David Stollery's house. And they go to the house and immediately start taking over. The two leading people leave to do their play. Bud immediately steals one of the cigars and sits down comfortably to relax. And Lou goes to take care of the kids. Now, I say kids. There's a little girl, baby, an infant, in a crib. And then there's David Stollery, who's off to the side. When he walks into the room, you don't really see him. So when Lou comes in, first of all, there's a roller skate there placed by David Stollery. And Lou, or Lou's double, does an incredible fall when he comes in. And a lot of stuff was cut from this scene, and I'm going to tell you what it was. But what it is basically is he sees the baby, the infant, and he thinks the baby's talking to him. But it's David Stollery over to the other side. And Lou's thinking, my God, this baby must be a ventriloquist. It's not moving its lips, yet it's talking. You know, funny stuff, really funny stuff. But what happens here in what they cut, and they filmed it, is Lou carries a suitcase through this, and it's all his equipment. It's diapers and powder and everything else you need. And he picks up the baby just to kind of get to know it, and he realizes that it's wet. So he takes it over to the desk, and he lays the baby down. Now, the baby starts to roll off the desk, and he grabs it in time, and he figures he's got to do something. So he puts he puts bookends on on each end of the baby while he diapers it. And he does it. He diapers it and everything. But he's it's so funny. And I can't believe they cut it. It really that really would have landed. Really nice. But anyway, as without that, it just he turns around and sees who is actually talking. And he goes over to sit with David Stollery. Now, during this time, David Stollery hits him on the head with an Indian club. or should I say Native American club? neither of which I belong to. The dues were too expensive. And the don'ts, forget it. I'm back. But anyway, so he settles in, and David Stollery is much more intelligent than Lou, has a much bigger vocabulary, tells him that he's a problem child, he's been to psychiatrists and all of this. So Lou actually goes to hit him with the book and then realizes that it's Jack and the Beanstalk. And he's like, oh, Jack and the Beanstalk, my favorite novel, which I love. And he proceeds to read the book to David Stollery. Of course, he can't get through certain words, and David has to help him. And then eventually Lou asks him, can you read it? You know, you read better than I do, and I'd love to hear it. And of course, Lou falls asleep and dreams that he is Jack, and his last name is Strong, Jack Strong. And all of a sudden there is a freeze, a frame of the house set. Jack's and his mother live in the house. It's their yard, you know, with the fence and a road outside the yard. And slowly the colors start patching in. you know, over to the right, then you'll see some reds, then you'll see some greens. And by the time it finishes, the picture starts rolling again, and Lou is Jack in his little Jack outfit, and complete color. And it's just beautiful. It really is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to say that it's beautiful like The Wizard of Oz, which was absolutely glorious when she walks out of that house. And when I read that that wasn't done optically, it was all done with lighting.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't change anything. She walked out and the lighting was different and everything was colorful. It wasn't optical. It was actually done in real time.
Yeah.
But it's actually much more effective, I think, than this transition. But we're not complaining because Abbott and Costello have a color movie now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Lou's playing on the fence. He's, you know, going back and forth and he gets his hand caught in it and all this Lou stuff. Now, one of the biggest criticisms of this film by the critics themselves was that Lou was, let's say, they started shooting in 51 or 52. So he was about 46 years old and he was playing a boy. He was playing Jack. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't get it. It's like, what were these people watching the last 10, 15 years that they were watching? Who were they watching? It was Lou, who was a child. He was a man child.
Yep. Yep.
So it totally works for me. And I never questioned it until I read these reviews. So, yeah. So reviewers, you know, take a pill. So Lou is playing in the yard. And what should happen? We see a carriage in the distance being pulled by all these horses. And it's actually from another film. Actually, the first Super Cinecolor film. And I'm trying to figure out what that was. It was something like The Sword of Monte Cristo or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those, you know, sword and, you know, dashing swashbuckler movies.
Yeah.
And and then they actually had the same carriage come into the close-up, you know, where Lou was. So that worked out, although there were less horses once they showed up as Lou's. Maybe they sold them in between shots. Maybe they sold them to Bubba, you know, for meat. And if you know what I mean by that, if you've seen the film. So anyway, the princess comes. That's Shay Kogan. She comes out. She tells Lou her tale of woe. The giant has stolen everything from the kingdom. All the riches, all the jewels, even their hen that lays golden eggs. That's Lou's hen. And she's forced to marry a prince from another kingdom, a sight unseen. So it's like a prearranged, and she's not crazy about the idea, of course. And Lou is trying to be very positive. What if he's young and handsome and, you know, you could fall in love with him? And she's like, yeah, what are the chances? So he goes over. I love when he goes over to the well to get her a drink of water, and he leans over just as the mother is ripping a piece of cloth in half, and you hear the and he's like, uh-oh, the pants. it's very cute. But there's a whole other scene that was cut featuring Billy the goat. The mother at one point says, you know, would you just take care of the goat? I'm so tired of saying this. You're starting to look like a goat. And so he goes over to the well, and he looks down into the water, and the goat, without him knowing it, is next to him looking into the water, and he sees the goat's reflection, and he's like, oh my God, my mom was right. I do look like a goat. And then he catches Billy and says, oh, you, why don't you go butt something soft, right? And he leans over the well, and you see the goat actually reason and think, his butt would be nice. And he butts a Lou in the butt, and Lou falls into the water for the end of the scene. But all cut. That's all cut. But there is a great line where the mother, at this point, the princess is gone. She doesn't really believe him. She thinks he's, you know, addlepated, and that the princess really didn't come. And she says,
princesses don't talk to peasant boys. Oh, Jack, when are you going to grow up and get some sense?
Does one go with the other?
I think it's my favorite line in the movie because it's just so... it's so right on. And it's really smart. That's smart writing. But anyway, the mother is played by a familiar face for movie buffs, Barbara Brown. She was born in Los Angeles in 1901, which means she had Lou when she was 5 years old. Must have been quite a delivery. I'm thinking Amazon. But who knows? But anyway, she was actually became a stage actress from the time from 1922 when she was 21. Then she was on Broadway till 1941, going from play after play after play. And then she got a call from was it Columbia Studios? Yeah, for the Fred Astaire Rita Hayworth movie. She played Rita Hayworth's mother in You Were Never Lovelier in 1942. She did two Ma and Pa Kettle movies. She was the in-law of what's his name? The mother of Richard Long. So yeah, so it was Ray Collins and Barbara Brown with Percy Kilbride and Marjorie Main. So they were New York sophisticates with Ma and Pa Kettle. And two of the better ones, Ma and Pa Kettle Back on the Farm and Ma and Pa Kettle On Vacation. Two good ones. And what else? She had quite a career for herself. And she passed away in 1975 at the age of 74. So Barbara Brown is the mother, and she tells Jack, and this used to disturb me when I was a child. Let me just do a slight preamble. When this movie was on, and tell me if you agree, Jerry, okay, when we were kids, when this movie came around, which was only like once a year, me and my family were in front of the TV and we loved it. You know, it was that exciting. So, so this whole thing was, you know, I was very invested in it. Yeah. So when the mother says you have to sell the cow, you have to sell Henry, my heart would break, you know, and, you know, eventually Lou would have to leave it with Mr. Dinklepuss, the butcher. And I'm thinking, the butcher? Oh, my God, that's this beautiful cow, you know, that's wearing makeup, actually, is going to be killed and chopped up, you know, and eaten.
Well, you know, I got to say, since you brought it up, I was watching it this time on the new restored Blu-ray edition.
Yeah.
I had never noticed the makeup on the cow any other time I had seen this movie.
It's so funny. Gosh. It really is. I mean, not only does it have like
the rouge,
the red stuff on the cheeks, rouge, rouge on it. It's got lipstick on. Mm-hmm. It actually, and this is the makeup man was actually interviewed. I think it was Abe Haberman. He had to put fake eyelashes on the cow every morning. He said, "You have no idea what that was like." But the cow did end up at the Costello farm, their ranch, and lived out its life. So, yeah, one more thing that Lou brought home. So he's told that he has to bring Henry. And another cut scene is the mother saying, "You can't call the cow Henry. You know, it's a cow. It's got udders, da 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 da." He goes, "Okay, okay, I'll call him Albert." And then he turns around and says, "Come on, Henry." So he's walking Henry to his doom or her doom. And as he's walking through the forest, he happens upon a fairly good looking guy on a horse. And he's told that he is the prince that is supposed to marry the princess. And Lou is secretly delighted because he's a good looking man and he looks like someone that she could fall in love with. And, you know, so they talk about that and they talk about the giant and the lights flash. This is how they did this. And I remember I was fascinated by this when I was a kid. Whenever the giant stole something or somebody, the lights would flash on the screen. Like it would go dark and then light, dark and light. And then once it came light again permanently, the thing was missing. So at this point, the prince was missing. He's gone. The giant has kidnapped him the way he kidnapped the princess. We didn't say that, but she was. She was kidnapped during the time between Lou, the cow, and whatever. The giant has royalty upstairs. So Lou pretty much is at sea. And one of my favorite gags in the whole movie comes up at this point where he doesn't know where the prince is. And he starts yelling, "Prince, prince." And about 800 dogs come from nowhere and jump on him. And just, it's like a dog orgy. They're just like all over the place. And because he yelled Prince. And from what I learned, that was the most popular name for a male dog that year, actually. So, that must have been quite a laugh at that point. I think it's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Now, here's a strange cut. This movie, our television version, Jerry, the one we watched when we were little nippers, knee high to a giant's ankle, we were seeing the preview print. It somehow got out. There were scenes that Lou eventually cut out for the release print. So we were seeing it's almost like the Marx Brothers movie Love Happy. There were two prints of it in circulation. And we always got the weird print. It looked unfinished, you know? And only within the last 10 years or so, did the new one come out. And you saw scenes that explained some of the things that were unexplainable in the original print we saw. So this print is something like that. Now, here's where I'm a little at sea. I don't know why he cut this, but there was a whole scene where Lou brings Henry into the village, which the mat work is just beautiful. It looks like a storybook. And he talks to Joe Kirk, his brother-in-law, and Almira Sessions, who's also in the movie. And he talks about the giant kidnapping the prince and the princess and, you know, everything else. And they look at him like he's addlepated. Oh, Jack, you say these things all the time. But it establishes what he was within the village. So sort of like the village idiot, you know?
Yeah.
And then you cut to Bud. Now, Bud plays Mr. Dinklepuss. Now, Mr. Dinklepuss is the butcher, the town butcher. He has a tiny little piece of steak in the window with a sign saying just for show, you know, I'm not selling this. It's all I have. So basically he's talking to the townspeople who are yelling at him. You can't charge black market prices and all this stuff. That's criminal, you know, and they know that Lou is bringing the cow now. So they've, you know, from the previous scene. So they're yelling at Bud, you have a cow coming. You're going to have meat. You're going to have this and we want this. But Bud is showing us that he's a criminal, you know, that he's been selling black market prices for the little amount of meat that he has. So, but that's all cut out, you know, and it's all expository. It's important that we know who this guy is. So Mr. Dinklepuss with his new mustache, by the way, he grew the mustache for this movie. And his daughter, Vicky, tells the story about when she came down to breakfast one morning and saw the mustache and said, what's that? and he went, shut up. What is with you? No. He said, I'm growing a mustache for this film we're doing. It's a costume picture and I want it to look different. And she said, I hope you're not going to keep it. And he said, I don't know, maybe I will. And he did, right up until they shot Dance With Me Henry, their last film. Yeah. But anyway, I think he looks great. And he's got the long hair, you know, he looks terrific. He cleans up nicely. So anyway, this is where they start the film. Lou is already there with the cow in front of the shop. And Bud is just saying, come on in, I'll give you the best deal I can, but, you know, I'll do my best. And he closes the door. But first he looks around suspiciously, so you know he's suspicious. So, you know, they take the cow back there. Now, here's where I'm wondering why John Grant isn't around. But apparently they cut the whole cow udders routine that they did in Ride 'Em Cowboy. But the difference being Bud would take Lou's role. Oh, yeah, it's with the udder. The udder what? You know, the otter, and I'm sure he said, you know, that six tube set down there. But Bud was the comic. Huh. But they cut it. They ended up cutting it, and it was down to bare bones. But here is the scene when I was a kid, and, you know, I couldn't take it. When he said goodbye to Henry.
Oh, yeah.
I would cry. And you would see Henry crying. They would have to put, you know, they would have to put tears there. But yeah, it just killed me. It's like, this is a character. This is his best friend, and he's leaving him to be chopped up. I couldn't reconcile it in my mind, my little mind. I still can't. But that's my head injury. But anyway, so he says this tearful goodbye, and word is around. This is where we find out word is getting around. You hear it on the street. The princess has been kidnapped. The princess has been kidnapped. The giant has the princess. So he has to do something. So he sells the cow to Mr. Dinklepuss, who gives him 5 magic beans. Money? What do you want with worthless money? These are magic. So Lou, of course, takes the beans. and leaves Henry. And not long after he leaves, we get that lighting effect again, and Henry disappears. So the giant also kidnapped Henry. And Bud comes out and he is appalled. Where's the cow? I gotta slap somebody. So so Lou goes home and tells his mom that he made the best deal in the world and shows her the five magic beans. Oh boy. And she is very, very upset. And she says, plant the beans. Maybe we could grow something to eat, you know, whatever. Oh, Jack, you're such a moron. And she goes into the house. And Lou has a little inner monologue, but apparently it was all ad-lib.
Oh, you're not ordinary beans, are you? Please, beans. Will you grow like magic beans so I can prove to my mother and everybody else that I'm not addled brain like they think I am? Or am I? Oh, magic beans. One, two, three, four, five. Grow. Please grow.
That was all Lou going at it. Not in the script. So he goes to bed after planting the beans, and one of my favorite shots in the movie is Lou in his nightshirt with his wig, you know, looking like a little boy.
Yeah.
Hanging out the window, begging the beans to grow until the mother's like, Jack, will you go to bed? And he, yes, mother. And he goes to bed. So he wakes up the next day. First, we see some animation. Now, Lou claimed this little bit of animation of the beanstalk starting to grow cost $9,000. And he remembered it as being much more elaborate, but it really is. It's like a 2-second shot of it growing, and it's cool. It's really nice, but it's, you know, I doubt it was $9,000. So he wakes up in the morning and he does this wonderful take when he walks past the beanstalk. He takes a look at it very casually, starts to walk away again, and then boom, you know, the biggest double take on the face of the earth. And he can't believe it. He looks up. I love the painting of the the beanstalk, you know, going up into wherever it goes, into oblivion. Yeah. And he's like, he's calling, Mother! Mother!
Mother!
Jack, what do you want?
Will you please get my mother?
I am your mother.
Mother. Look! Look! The beanstalk!
Yes, and it's a great moment. So they have this beanstalk all of a sudden. And the townspeople, we get a reaction shot from them. Actually, it was kind of cut. They cut it down. Bud was involved. Footage is on the extras in the new Blu-ray Classic Flicks production. And you see Bud, you know, what's going on? Oh, there's a beanstalk. Let's go. And as he's going, he slightly looks at the camera. But not in a good way. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, I hope I don't run into the camera. It was that kind of a look. And it's a brief second. But I notice all these things. And it might have been why they didn't use it. I don't know. But anyway, they all show up at Jack's house to see this amazing miracle. And they do the first song. And it's the song Jack and the Beanstalk. And it's actually a very good song. Unfortunately, there are dancers involved. And these are the... You just heard a sigh of from my friend Jerry. Johnny Conrad and his dancers, and I'm holding up, you know, quotation marks. It looks like they were on their way to work when Johnny turned around and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. It's maybe the worst choreography I've ever seen in any film at any time. He likes to spin. I'll say that. He likes to spin. Mm-hmm. And there's four women with him, so he obviously chose four women out of his troupe. He was on the Colgate Comedy Hour, but I believe he was on with Martin and Lewis. I think that's where Lou saw him and probably got him cheap. But boy, terrible, just terrible. It's, first of all, if you watch closely, you'll see some of the women kind of like, for a split second, look panicky. Am I in the right place? You know, that kind of thing. And I never saw a person spin so much in my life. It's like, what? Stop spinning. Mm-hmm. Dance mm-hmm. or something. It's just quite simply the worst choreography you will ever see. And it's a delight to watch. you know, not in a good way, but in a way that it's like you feel superior. And, you know, you can't help but feel, you know, like Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
Right, Jar? Am I right?
I cannot agree with you more. In fact, I was going to say your initial statement of this might be the worst choreography. I was going to say you are being far too generous, my friend. It is the worst choreography I have ever seen in a motion picture.
Absolutely horrible.
I have a hard time calling it choreography.
Yeah, yeah. No, like I said, it's like he thought it up on the way to work.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's just terrible. Oh, it's just awful. And it's so hard to find stuff on him. I know he was born in Revere, Massachusetts in 1917. He did the Colgate Comedy Hour. He did a movie. He choreographed the dance in an independent film in 1965 called Once Upon a Coffee House, a Beatnik movie. And boy, his work beats Nick, let me tell you. but the interesting is Joan Rivers is actually in that movie as herself doing stuff.
Oh.
And he also choreographed on two episodes of the Vaughn Monroe Show on television. But that's it. That's all I have on him. I actually looked in with AI and asked, is Johnny Conrad still alive? And there is absolutely no information on the internet. And we did a deep search on the web. And I know, I'm sure he's dead, you know, 1917.
Yeah.
But when? How? You know, what?
Yeah.
I don't know. He's on third. Oh, and by the way, a friend of mine has these books published, you know, word search books.
Oh yeah.
He has a series of them, all movie based, and you have to look for titles of films and characters and all that stuff. So it gives it that extra edge. And I did my first blurb on a book in the back of the book. It's a quotation, Mix Anna Maria from blah, 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 mentions our podcast, but it's just, it's a fantastic, it's from the movie comedy team's version.
Nice.
Now, there was another point I was going to make about this. Not just that, but I can't remember what. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I just wanted to mention the books. It's the Papa Rock collection, Papa Rock's word searches, and they're available on Amazon, and they're quite a lot of fun. My mom loves them, by the way, and she's 94, and she does them, you know, she does them every day. So that's kind of nice.
Nice.
So Johnny Conrad, we don't know whether he's alive or dead. He could be the world's oldest untalented choreographer. We don't know. We just don't know. But if he spins anymore, I swear, you know, we're going to see his lunch come up, you know?
Oh my gosh. There was one move where he was doing this. He was about to do a leap and was spinning and prepping and making it look like it was going to be, you know, over the Empire State Building kind of a leap. And he goes like a foot.
If that.
What the heck?
They come back for the big finale, which is even
worse.
Of course. Well, you know what it is? There are times during this film, and I do like this film. It is a really delightful fantasy. But sometimes the sets, especially the house, the Jack set, looks like a pantomime, like a stage pantomime,
like
a British pantomime. And the dancers only make that worse. You know what I mean? It's hard to explain,
but
all the spinning. So anyway, so we get out of the spin cycle. And when Bud hears that there is a hen that lays golden eggs, 24 karat, that the giant has stolen, he is all aboard. He is like, let's go. We've got to go get the giant. I'm not scared anymore. Let's go. So the boys have to climb the beanstalk, the base of which is actually a eucalyptus tree, is the trunk of a eucalyptus tree. They put leaves on it and spikes to climb.
Yeah.
And that serves as the beanstalk. Their doubles did most of the work in the, you know, medium shots as they're going up.
Yeah.
But Lou, during the course of the song they're singing, he does a solo that I think we should hear right now.
What is Jack ever coming back?
I'll be back, and when I reappear with the giant by the beard, you will
does that high note that he just holds forever.
And
in an interview, he told somebody, he said, they mentioned his singing and that it was very good. And he said, every Italian has some singing in them. And for the most part, that's very true. We're a very musical culture, you know, between opera and Dean Martin, you know, we've got it covered. But anyway, he hits that note and it really does. It's pretty thrilling, you know,
because
we don't know he can go there. We do now. So yeah, they're climbing and they get to what Lou calls giant land. He can't say giant in two syllables. He says it in one syllable, giant. Giant. He says believe the same way. Believe.
Yep.
B-L-E-E-V-E. Believe. But anyway, that's New Jersey. That's
I was going to say, those folks in Patterson don't like to waste time. So, you know, they talk that way.
You cut a syllable out, you've got your whole day ahead of you. They're in giant land. So they're making their way. And I think it was a mistake and that they left in. He knocks off Bud's hat by accident as he's climbing off the thing, and they look down, and you could just imagine the hat falling for miles and miles and miles. And Bud looks at him like, you jerk. Now I don't have a hat. You know, that's part of my costume, for crying out loud. So they're walking through the forest. They're heading towards the matte painting of the castle, which I really like, by the way.
Yep.
Again, it looks like a storybook.
Mm-hmm.
And they do their whole shadow sequence, which means the giant is actually behind them. And Bud sees his shadow, and it looks totally normal. And Lou's shadow looks like it has a thyroid problem. And they start doing things where they have to match the movement. And, of course, eventually it doesn't match. You know, the giant doesn't budge. And Bud does one of the greatest takes of all time. He looks at the giant, and it's laugh-out-loud funny. He's just he's got the stuff, you know. He's terrific. He's just terrific. He does this like triple take and runs off, you know, leaving Lou. And this allows Lou to do his solo song. And I have to say, whenever I bring this movie up to Abbott and Costello fans, they start singing the song. Let's just play a little bit.
A man believes what he believes.
And by these principles, a man must stand.
A time will come for rolled up sleeves.
And it might help to have a fist on hand.
If I believe that I am right, there's only one thing to be done. I don't go looking for a fight, but I have never run away from one.
But only fools will take a dare.
And there are things that only fools don't find.
If you spell trouble in the air,
I'll hold my breath until a breeze blows by. I'll snore defiance like some rhinoceros, afraid of giants. Now isn't that preposterous? I find courage a thing of great delight. Sing filii and filii with steady hand and steely eye. I fear nothing when I am in the right.
And if you notice, during this song, some of the animals are singing back to him. And they are all voiced by Mel Blanc. Isn't that
totally
great?
Totally uncredited. Yeah.
Completely. But Warner Brothers?
Yes.
Right?
I was going to bring up that point. Yeah.
Yeah. He's still working at Warner Brothers. And it probably took him 10 minutes. He made $250, which really translates to like 2000 something.
Yeah.
In today's money. And did very well. He didn't. And he used my favorite Mel Blanc voice.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah,
I love that voice.
Marvin,
I know he's gonna lose the fight, or my name isn't Lattimore, and it isn't.
I love that voice. So anyway, that's the song. People start saying, "I fear nothing when I am in the right," or politically on the right.
I just love some of the rhyme schemes in this number as well, you know, about being obstreperous and then he's going to salt and pepper us, you know.
It's just fantastic. Really, really. Not a bad answer to The Wizard of Oz lyrics, you know.
Yeah.
Ip Harburg wrote lyrics like that. But they're very good. It's a good song, a very good song.
It is.
And it leads him to do one of my favorite things that he does, the laugh into the cry as he collapses at the foot of the giant.
Yes.
Now, one thing about the giant, at a screening, a test screening, the kids weren't scared by him, you know? So they actually inserted a bunch of shots that made him look like a maniac. The lighting is darker and his eyes are vicious looking and scowling. So you put that in every so often and it changed everything. He became a real villain. I love when Lou sees the giant, he runs and he actually passes Bud, even though Bud had been running through the entire song. So anyway, we cut to inside the castle where we meet Dorothy Ford again. Just like The Wizard of Oz, all the characters they meet in black and white world show up in Lou's dream sequence in color. So she is the giant's housekeeper, and she's educating the princess as to how to act and all this stuff as she takes her to her cell, where the prince is also held, not in the same cell, but in different cells. And that's a good selling point, I think. Sorry, I picked that up at the bar. So they talk back and forth, and she finds out that he's actually playing a mandolin, or pretending to play a mandolin, and, you know, writing a song, and, you know, they flirt back and forth, and it's very nice. But you cut outside, and the giant, has Bud and Lou under each arm. You know, Lou under one arm, Bud under the other. And for some reason, this is one of my favorite scenes, he's knocking on the door with Lou's head. Not Bud's, Lou's. And he's banging into it. Open the door! And Lou starts yelling, open the door! Open the door! It's so funny. And finally, Dorothy Ford lets them in. And they do a gag that doesn't work. The whole thing, the giant is, you know, talking about wanting food and he's hungry and all this stuff. And Lou is like doing his scared and, you know, shtick, the all that stuff. And the giant's like, you know, what's the matter with you? And Lou's like, you're standing on my foot. You know, he's wearing those like Frankenstein boots, you know, that actually look like they would crush your foot. But the timing is off. Apparently, Buddy didn't come in with his cue quickly enough. So Lou is doing more and more shtick. And in the meantime, we're all guessing what the joke is before he gets to it. So unfortunately, they kept that in. I don't know why they did, but they did. But anyway, the giant leaves them to Dorothy Ford, who takes them in and shows them the ropes. And another favorite scene of mine is she pours milk for Bud and Lou, and Lou tastes the milk and says, wait a minute, Henry, that's Henry's milk. You know, no milk is sweeter than Henry's. And he spills some and he starts the liquid on the table. He puts the cup down and he starts scraping the liquid back into the cup that he had spilled. And Bud stops him and slaps, what are you doing? What is, stop that. And Lou's like, I'm trying to save the milk. Look at Dorothy Ford during this. It's one of my hobbies to look at. I love to watch people watching Abbott and Costello, and she's very amused because it's all ad lib. Lou wasn't supposed to be scraping the milk in and all this stuff. It's all ad lib. So that's a wonderful moment. So anyway, they are with Dorothy Ford, and Dorothy Ford shows some romantic interest in little Lou, which is interesting. Considering, you know, the height difference, it would be like, you know, I don't know, who was it? I was going to say Lou Alcindor. How about that?
There you go. Like,
let's say a basketball player with, you know, with Hervé Villachez. That's what it would look like. But anyway, they're getting along, and we meet Patrick the Harp. Now, Patrick is probably the most detestable character in the movie. He's this Irish harp. He's got a head. The mouth doesn't move, but when the strings, you see the strings moving, vibrating as he talks. So he's a talking harp. I don't know why he bought a talking harp. He could have just got married. But Oh boy, every woman just turned off the podcast. So, but anyway, right away, there's hatred between Bud and Lou and the harp. And the voice is a very familiar voice to film buffs. A voice from an actor who was actually brought over from Ireland, from the Abbey Players, by John Ford, the director John Ford, for the movie Plough in the Stars in 1936. His brother also came with him. Arthur Shields is the actor that does Patrick the Harp. But his brother was known as Barry Fitzgerald, who won the Oscar for Going My Way. Every Irish imitation is Barry Fitzgerald. Yes. But this is his brother, Arthur Shields, who had quite the career himself. And he was doing the harp. And I'm sure just like Mel Blanc, it probably took him 10 minutes to record all the dialogue. And by that time, he was doing another movie. And you know what that movie was? The Quiet Man. One of my favorite films in general. So yeah, John Ford was his godfather, the movie godfather. So they lock Patrick away in a cabinet, which used to bother me when I was a child because I'm claustrophobic. I'm too sensitive. I'm just too sensitive a person. They put this mock, you know, thing in a cabinet and close the doors and lock it. And I'm like, oh my God, the poor harp. He's in the dark in a closet. Oh my God. And you know, that was my college years. No. And I forgot to mention one thing. When the giant goes to, there were the same bear from Ride 'em Cowboy, Naughty 90s. The guy in the bear costume. The giant just goes over, gives him one punch, boom, and he's down. That's it.
Yep.
Bear meat. So anyway, I just wanted to mention the bear again because, you know, he's ubiquitous. And that would be his name if it were a cartoon character. Ubiquitous Bear.
Yeah, I
like it. And he'd have a little sidekick, you know, Ubiquitous Bear and Annoying Man or something. Anyway. So when the giant is saying fee-fi-fo-fum, that is a phrase that actually I think in writing it was first seen in King Lear by a guy named Shakespeare.
Really?
But it was way before then. And it means, I need food. I need food. I'm hungering right now.
Mm.
So isn't that interesting? The fee-fi-fo-fum. And we've all said it. We all used to say it when we were kids, and it actually means something.
Yeah.
So anyway, now we cut to the part where all the kids got up to make a sandwich. probably Fluffernutter, you know?
Marshmallow Fluff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, Marshmallow Fluff. Oh, that was like manna from heaven. let's face it. Seriously, just when you walk by it in the supermarket, every fiber in your being wants you to buy it, you know, take it home and just eat it in one sitting. But I don't, because my Greek friend diabetes visits.
Yes.
I don't have it, but I'm just saying that enough of that stuff will give you that. So anyway, what I mean is, this is time for James Alexander to sing the first song. And it's the name that the princess, gave him. It's a fake name, Darlene. And he sings Darlene. Now, the funny thing is, the song was like three times as long, but Lou had the good sense to cut everything out of the song except three choruses of the name Darlene. So it was Darlene, my darling, Darlene, Darlene, my darling, Darlene. And that's it. Yeah. So Dar was very lean. I love how when they're setting up the rendezvous, now I had to look up when I was a little kid. Now listen, you Gen Xers and your Gen Zers, I actually went to an encyclopedia and looked up rendezvous. And that's not easy because it's spelled really weird.
Yes.
But I had to look it up. I had to know what it was, and I found out. And I love when Lou does the little curtsy to say goodbye and he hits his chin on the bar. Oh, he's so funny. And then he goes to the prince and follows up with, you know, you're going to have the rendezvous and blah, blah, blah. We're going to set it up. And he does the curtsy again, but this time he's got a food tray in his hand and he hits that on his head. And after he hits it on his head, he turns around and with full purpose walks right into a wall. Nobody does this like Lou Costello. Every time you laugh, it's just so funny. He's like a magnet to these walls and doors and everything, yep. posts and pillars. But anyway, but first with this one, he does the chin thing and then he turns to us and winks at us and then walks right into the wall. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's just great. So they do their song and oh boy, darling, my darling, darling. And Bud has a great idea. Catapults. That's how they can get over the giant's wall and, you know, get back to the beanstalk and climb down. So he's making these catapults out of these trees. And you're thinking, boy, Bud, huh? This is kind of unlike Bud to be so, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Resourceful.
Oh, resourceful is great. Thank you. So, yeah, you're pretty resourceful yourself. So, he's making these things, and the princess comes over, and he shows them, and everybody's impressed. But Lou says, isn't this kind of dangerous? And Bud says my favorite line in the movie from Bud. And he says,
well, it's far too dangerous for a human being. But get on here. I'll show you what we're working on. Okay.
Wait a minute. Too dangerous. Much too dangerous for a human being.
And Lou is about to get on when he realizes what he just heard. What do you mean, not for a human being? I'm a human being, you know. And so Lou goes away from Bud, and they have their, he sets up the rendezvous for the prince and princess. Is this where they do Dreamer's Cloth? They do another song called The Dreamer's Cloth or something. I wish they would have wiped it away with that cloth. I mean, you know what? For a ballad, it's pretty, but it just doesn't belong. It's just not, you know, it just slows things up. So anyway, this leads to more comical things, especially the dance he does with Dorothy Ford.
Oh, yes.
Now, right? Now, this is sort of a remake of the dance he does with Joan Davis in Hold That Ghost, mm-hmm. which I feel is superior to this one, but not by much. Not by much. It was different. There was not the size difference between him and Joan Davis, right? So the gags were planned differently. In this one, it's all about her overpowering him and abusing him during the dance. Mm-hmm. And she must have been a relative of Bud Abbott's because she has no idea she's doing it. You know, she takes no responsibility at all. So there are some bits in this that I just love. You know, the thing with her elbows, she's got her hands behind her head and she's doing this turn and the elbows hit him in the head every time. And he thinks to duck the next time and she just spins around and gets him in the back of the head. It's really clever stuff. There's the, where he tries to lift her and then finally she lifts him and he hits the metal ball hanging from the chandelier and he falls on the floor. And he does something that he used to do in the Colgate Comedy Hour all the time. Whenever he had to dance, he would kick off one of his shoes and they would go flying into the audience. And he tries it during this. You could see the shoe is loosened and he kicks and it doesn't work. It just flops like a foot in front of him, so mm-hmm. to speak. And he very quickly, and this is, you got to love him for this. He didn't want to cut, you know? So he reaches down very quickly and he throws it over his back out where he wanted it to go and then gets right back into the dance. That's a trooper. That's a real trooper.
Yep.
So, and it's great. It's just, the whole thing is great. She's kicking him in the face. She's, you know, you name it. She does it to him. Mm. And they finish where she's wraps her skirt around him and they both fall. And the first thing I see is Lou's hand is on her butt. he moves it immediately, believe me. It's a very quick move. But for those of you who like to listen to these things and go back and check, mark my words. Okay, so that dance is done. One of the great visuals from this movie is Bud looking for the hen that lays the golden eggs. How does he do that? He goes into the chicken coop with a hammer and hammers their little butts. And listen, is gold or is this an hammering chicken butts? It's just, you would never believe it. If someone mentioned it to you, you would never believe it. So anyway, or believe it. So this also happens while Lou is making his famous chicken feed, you know, for the chickens. And he accidentally hits the horn that has gunpowder in it, and it pours into the chicken feed. So you've got chicken feed mixed with gunpowder. which I first remembered from a comedy team called Moran and Mac.
Yep.
They were a blackface team, two white guys in blackface, and they do it in a short in 1930, where gunpowder gets mixed with the chicken feed and the eggs become exploding eggs. And that's what happens here. The hens eat all the gunpowder food, and the giant is in his room, you know, with the big table with the fireplace behind him, and he's calling for food. He's ready for an omelet, you know, and Lou says, "You want a large omelet? Two eggs?" And he goes, "22 eggs. Are you kidding?" So Lou keeps breaking them, putting them in the pan, and they explode. And the giant's like, "What is going on?" And they keep exploding. And he's like, he moves Jack out of the way. "Let me do it." And he breaks an egg and breaks another egg, breaks another egg, and nothing's happening. He's stirring it. And you cut to Lou watching him, and it's with the face of someone who knows what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you hear the explosion off camera, and you see Lou's expression, and you cut to the giant who has eggs all over his face. He still says he's hungry, and as he's saying he's hungry, he starts seeing that Lou's kind of chubby. He's got some meat on him. And the next thing you know, Lou's on a rotisserie over the fire, being turned, roasted, alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he's yelling, "Mr. Dinklepuss! Mr. Dinklepuss!" Which is something we used to do as kids after we watched this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing how horrible that is as a vision. You know, we found it funny. It was cartoony, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then the giant has a great moment with Bud before this. The giant's looking at all the jewels he's stolen, and they're big diamonds and rubies and, you know, you name it. And he's going through them, and Bud's like practically drooling as he's watching the giant. And the giant says, "Can I trust you to put these away for me?" And Bud says, "Well, frankly, no." And the giant eventually gives it to him and says, "I like a dishonest man who admits it." So yeah, there's philosophy in that there's sense to that. So he gives it to Bud, and you know, Bud has the jewels in his hands. And then they bring the hen out that lays the golden eggs. And of course, Bud is, you know, doing backflips in his head. Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's get to where we're going. Now it's time to subdue the giant and get the hell off giant land. So, Bud, again, with James Alexander, they hook up this huge, it looks like a log, you know, huge log attached to mm-hmm. a chain, which is attached to the ceiling. So it gives it that arc. As you push it, it would go right into the giant's stomach and knock him out because it's such a big thing. Now, that's amazing that they thought about this and that they were able to do it. But that's exactly what happens. The giant is knocked out. And that starts their escape. This is like the big chase now. So they're running around and they're trying to get out. The door is locked, so they can't get out of the castle. And Lou comes up with an idea that with his whip, he will pull the chandelier up by the mantelpiece, which is huge. And each person would get a hold of the chandelier and swing through the window, which is open, and out, you know, to freedom. So he does it first with James Alexander, and he goes out, and then Shay Gogan, she goes out, and then Bud, who has the jewels in one hand and the chicken, the hen that lays golden eggs, in the other. He's holding by the feet upside down, but it's a live chicken. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a live, scared chicken. And Bud, as sort of like payback for his greed, "No, these are mine, mine." He goes back to his Africa Screams greedy character.
Yeah, yeah.
And as payback, I suppose, when he swings out, the windows just happen to close as he's going, and he crashes through the window and out into the open. Unfortunately, we see it all happen from a very good angle, and you see the poor chicken is going through this glass. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm sure it's sugar glass, but still, the poor thing. So anyway, everybody's out but Jack, and Jack needs to deal with the giant. So there's a big fight, there's sword fighting, you know, there's a great shot of him up on the mantelpiece with his sword, you know, fighting the giant who's down below. Mm-hmm. And he jumps off the mantelpiece, and for some reason, there's like a makeshift bed underneath the mantelpiece. I mean, why? Where did it come from? What do they do with it? Who sleeps there?
See, now you're trying to put logic into this thing.
No, so. I know. I should have left that at the door. But anyway, that gives him a chance to do the trampoline stuff where the giant keeps swiping at him, but he's jumping over it. Mm-hmm. And eventually he slides onto the table. And, you know, it's just one Bugs Bunny thing after another. You know, yep. He goes in one door, he comes out another one, then another one. It's all Bugs Bunny. And finally, he does something with the table where the bucket lands on the giant's head. The giant can't see. And Lou leads him to the door and walks him through the door so he can get out. Mm-hmm. And that gives him a chance to put his foot on the giant and say, I fear nothing when I am in the right. I guess they were trying to sell that record. And by the way, they did. This was the only movie they made a record of. They made the songs and the story. And I'd love to get my hands on it.
Ooh,
But anyway, yeah, that's and then Paul Winchell and Jerry Mahoney recorded one or two of the songs from the movie. But anyway, so Lou gets out. Now, this is the point where the prince and princess are running away. Bud is running with the chicken and the jewels. And at one point, he turns to see if Lou is behind him, sees he isn't, and waves him off like, ah, screw him. And continues running. And I'm thinking, this is why Laurel and Hardy are more regarded or better regarded than Abbott and Costello. Can you imagine Ollie saying, ah, the hell with them, I'm going. Or Stan saying, I'm leaving. No, they would not leave each other. They would help each other.
Yeah.
Bud just writes him off like he's nothing. It's weird. It's just weird. I don't like it. It's uncomfortable. But anyway, he does it. And eventually, oh, I love that they do the catapults. Out mm-hmm. of the thing. So they do the prince, they do the princess, and Bud does it, and he tells Lou, don't forget to get on. And what does Lou do? He forgets to get on. And he releases the catapult, and nobody goes over. But the giant is after him, and he's doing more Bugs Bunny stuff. He's pretending to be a fountain. He's whatever. And the giant runs through the wall, and we're able to get out in the open. And that's when they do the biggest Bugs Bunny scene, which is the huge log. And Lou runs into it. The giant follows him. Lou comes out the other end. You know, it's just back and forth, very Bugs Bunny. But it ends with a great gag. He still has one of the exploding eggs, and he knows the giant is inside the log, and he tosses the egg inside the log, and there's a slow explosion with all the smoke coming out of the middle, out of both ends. It's very effective and very funny. Yep. So anyway, let's just get to the beanstalk, and they're climbing down, and Bud is having a little trouble. He's getting stuck, and all of a sudden, all the jewels fall out of the bag down to the ground below, and all the townspeople are thrilled. They're picking up all these diamonds and everything, mm-hmm. and he drops the chicken as well, who actually floats safely down, but he loses everything that he was greedy about, which is actually nice. I actually like that touch. And then... you know, Lou is following, and they all get to the ground. I left out one line when they were climbing at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Almira Sessions, who film buffs know and love, I know I do, and she was also on a million television shows, she turns to Jack's mother and says, "Don't worry, Mrs. Strong, he won't be back." And she says, "Oh, I know, but he's all I have," and blah blah blah. It's like nobody has any regard for him at all.
No.
What a horrible line! Don't worry, he won't be back. Don't worry, your son's going to die at the hands of the just like his father did. So anyway, they get down, and Lou decides, since he sees the giant is coming down, to chop down the beanstalk, and it's very funny. We loved this when we were kids. He would. He does all his axe stuff, his shtick. You know, he'd be chopping and it would stick in the thing, and he'd be chopping nothing for a while when he noticed that he doesn't have it in his hands anymore and grabs the thing. But what I really love is when he gets down to the final chop and it's still straight up, it's still holding, and he takes a little stone, a little rock, and tosses it lightly, and that's it. That's all it took. And you hear it, and you see Buddy Bayer as the giant fall off, and you hear him scream, and then you hear a big poof, and you see a Buddy Bayer sized hole in the ground. It's like, you know, the holes Lou made in Whodunit through the glass, you know, doors, and it was his silhouette. Well, this is the giant's silhouette. And apparently he went down to China, one of the people said. Mm-hmm. Two of which are Heine Conklin and Hank Mann from the Senate Studios.
Yeah.
So anyway, they do the Giant song, The Giant's Dead. He never looked better in his life. It's a cruel, funny song. Someday, by gosh, he'll be acres of squash, and he never looked better in his life. But the best thing about it is the dancers are back. And you're just praying that they're going to fall in the hole. And, you know, do their dance for Chinese people. Yeah. So anyway, the dancing is just horrible. And so they do the song. We play a little bit of that, Jer.
He met his doom.
He fought down and go, boom.
And he never looked better in his life.
Someday, by gosh, he'll be acres of squash.
And he never looked better in his life.
He's wearing several branches of the beanstalk for a necktie.
I never seen a better looking cook with so delectie.
His toes are curled and he's out of breath.
And then who should show up but the king? And the king is played by an actor who started out as one of the biggest stars of silent movies, definitely the highest paid. At one point, he was making $10,000 a week. $10,000 a week, pre-taxes.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking about a very rich man. And he was a great favorite of Lou Costello's when he was a boy. His name is William Farnham, brother of Dustin Farnham. They were both big stars at the time. And Lou made sure to hire him to get him work and keep his insurance going, his health insurance going, mm-hmm. because the following year he passes away. But the king is William Farnham. I think he was born in like 1875 or something like that. And he's quite good. He reminds me of, it's like a pantomime, you know, mm-hmm. it's a fairy tale. In the titles, in the opening titles, it says underneath, very small, it says, this is a fable. But it's not a fable. It's a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. So they got that wrong. But anyway, the romantic thing is solved. There's no more mistaken identity. She knows he's the prince. He knows she's the princess. And they kiss and, you know, have a sandwich. And while they're singing this song about Lou, you know, after it goes from he never looked better in his life to the original song, Jack and the Beanstalk. And Johnny Conrad, the spinning dancer, and one of his girls lifts Lou up on their shoulders. And I'm thinking, boy, that's where they earn their money. You know, they start parading Lou around on their shoulders. And Bud is behind him. And at one point he says, I manage this boy. He's got to get involved. If there's money involved, you can bet, you know, Bud is going to be there. And finally, he after the song, Lou is about to be knighted by the king. And we cut to the black and white bedroom of David Stollery, who actually does crown him with a vase that he breaks over his head. And this is just as the young lovers are coming home from rehearsal. And you hear Lou screaming, you know, I hate this kid. And Bud is like concerned, and they all show up in Mr. Fields' boarding house with the wallpaper. Mm. And Lou comes out, and Bud at one point hears that he was sleeping. So Bud slaps him, and that knocks Lou back into dream state. And he calls Bud Mr. Dinklepuss rather than Dink, which is his name in the movie, mm-hmm. In the black and white section. And he turns and he sees the prince and princess and he bows to them. And he starts singing, you know, they ask, what are you doing? And he's like, I fear nothing when I am in the right. It's a great Abbott and Costello ending. He even slaps Bud before he leaves. And Bud looks like, what the hell is going on? And Lou does his little dance step, finishes his song, and skips out, closes the door, the end. And it's clean, and it's great, and it's not the original ending.
Oh.
The original ending if you notice, they, at the beginning, as the young lovers are leaving, they have their costumes under their arms.
Yep.
Now, had the whole thing be done in color, we probably would have noticed them more. But apparently at the end of this one, they come home still in their costumes. And Lou thinks he's still in his dream, that they're the prince and the princess, you know? So it's more, it was more along those lines. It was more elaborate. But they kept his simplicity, and I think it works really quite nicely.
Yeah.
Now, this movie I always put in the same category as Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. It's their two Warner Brothers movies. It's their two independents, their two color movies. And when I was a child, I liked Jack and the Beanstalk more than Captain Kidd. As I got older, that sort of flipped. I liked Captain Kidd better than Jack and the Beanstalk. But the truth of the matter is, they're both not as good as they could be. Apparently, you know, let's face it, they were producing. You know, Alex Gottlieb was there to guide them, but, you know, like Lou said, you know, I love this script, we're going to film it. Had Alex been the sole boss, there would have been three rewrites and probably a better film.
Yeah.
So I think it's perfectly all right. It's actually fun to watch. You know, I was a little hesitant this time around because I watched it twice, actually. And I realized just how easy it was to watch it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't bored. I started noticing new things, and it's actually a very cute film. It's actually their most geared towards children. Now, Lou gave interviews about it, and he said that his main source of wanting to do this film were the Disney films that were coming out in the early 50s, the live action Disney films. And he wanted to capture that same sort of fantasy. And he also brought up The Wizard of Oz. You know, I wanted it to be like The Wizard of Oz, you know, going from color, you know, from black and white to color. And unfortunately, the critics noticed those interviews and made sure to say that it fell short of the Disney product and The Wizard of Oz. And it's true. It does fall short.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad film. Nope. And it's one I recommend. I recommend you to go back and watch it again. And watch it as a child. Try and watch it through a child's eyes, and you'll see, really, just how good it is. Just to see them sing and you know, be in a musical comedy world. Mm-hmm. At the very, towards the end, when they're all singing Jack and the Beanstalk or whatever, the Norman Luboff choir is in the background, and Bud is there too, in the front, off to the right. Mm-hmm. And I'm only saying this because you watch Bud faking everything. He's faking the singing. He's doing musical comedy movements, but they really don't lead anywhere. It's really funny. It's like, Bud, go over there and pretend you're part of it. So that's something to look out for too. But I really do. I really do enjoy this movie, and I don't think it's bad. I just think it could have been better. That's all. What do you think, Jer?
That's a fair assessment. And I was going to add to that, I think this and Meet Captain Kidd are perhaps the better choices for their color movies because of the fantasy storybook, you know, swashbuckle settings.
They're both costume films.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. It gave them that extra little something.
Absolutely.
Instead of having been done in black and white. And, you know, if we had had Hit the Ice in color, okay. But it would not have had the same impact, you know?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you saw the scenes they colorized for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. It's quite incredible. There's like 10 minutes of it on YouTube.
Okay.
And I want to see the whole movie in color. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. But you're absolutely right. This is a costume film. And in the same way that I enjoy Babes in Toyland with Laurel and Hardy, Mark and the Wooden Soldiers, I prefer it in color. I prefer the colorized version because it should have been in color. Mm-hmm. Just as these films look great in color. I just wish they were treated better at Universal. You know, Universal just, they really didn't respect them. They didn't respect them. And that's a shame because they were, you know, paying for their kids' college educations, you know. But anyway, so that's it. That was episode 30.
Yeah.
And next we have a film. And I think I am the least familiar with this film more than any of their others. and it's called Lost in Alaska. That'll be episode 31.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just one that I never really took to. Mm-hmm. So it never really stayed with me. There's a couple of scenes that I really like. I'm sure John Grant was responsible.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's almost somber, you know? Mm. And I don't mean the somber that Lou dances in Mexican Hayride, but I mean.
But yes, you're right.
Stop playing the samba. But yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know. We're going to discuss it. It'll be interesting. I watched it again when I was writing the book during COVID, and it was not hard to get through, and it had a really good cast. It's just not very memorable.
Mm.
But we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it next time. Again, my apologies to everyone for the delay in this, but you know, I actually had a head injury where I could lift my scalp away from my skull. And for a short while, I was a convertible. I had a convertible top. But rest assured that my goodness, I call her Betsy Ross. She did the most amazing stitching job that I've ever seen. And it's I'm on the mend, and I should be just fine for next time.
Yay!
Oh, and this is what I wanted to mention. When I mentioned these word search books,
yes,
that I have a blurb in the back.
Yes,
these are movie comedy team ones. And I'm forgetting what I was going to say.
Oh,
no. I have an excuse now, Jerry. There is a video coming out advertising these, and it's my voice doing Bud and Lou talking about the book. And he edited it so it looks like they're talking to each other. As soon as I have that, I'll post it on my page, on my Facebook page. And I want everyone to please subscribe to the YouTube page, where you get your Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. If you're on other podcast platforms, that's fine. You know, those are all tallied up for us. But we really need those numbers on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, I'm thinking rather than just stop everything, I could just stop posting them on YouTube. And you could look in, you know, the other platforms. But so many people are listening and not pressing any buttons. Like, you know. Whatever, yeah. And claiming to like it, and you know, where are you? We love it. It's a great companion during the day. We like to listen. So, please help us out here. You know, we're happy with the numbers. We're everything's aiming towards the 1,000 mark, but we really need you to subscribe and like, press like. And in the meantime, we will be back with Lost in Alaska, right, Jer?
Yay. We will indeed. Yes, we will not get lost
in Alaska.
We'll get lost somewhere else, maybe, but not in Alaska, no.
Oh, well. I love the way Bud says Alaska.
Yeah.
You know? It's like monster. Mm-hmm. Monster. Okay. Let's finish up here. We want to thank everyone for listening and for being here. We will see you next time. And really, give this movie a chance. If you have kids or grandkids, sit down with them. They will love it. Seriously. All right, everybody. Take good care of yourselves. Don't fall in your sleep. And I'm lucky to be alive, honestly. Take care.